Monica Beamer and Aaron Yankee talking about news from the Boo. But we wanted to just remind folks to go to the Willamette Week, Best of Portland.
Oh, yeah.
And vote for KBOO in many categories. You'll have to kind of surf through to see. We have lots of, we're in several categories. We're
absolutely
best nonprofit.
Yeah, best podcast for David Naiman and the Between the Covers, best DJs, best radio hip-hop personality, best hip-hop artist.
So yeah, please go and show your love. And thank you for joining us for News from the Boo.
Thanks, Monica.
It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival takes place this year from July 1st through 4th and includes performers like the Tedeschi Truck Band, Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Samantha Fish, and many, many more. Festival passes are on sale at early bird prices until May 31st. More information about the festival performers, the options for passes, and other information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the May 21st performance of Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez at the First Baptist Church in Portland at 7 p.m. Lalgudi Krishnan began his musical training at age 5, and over the years he has carved a niche for himself as a top-ranking violinist. Shahid Parvez descends from 6 generations of sitarists and is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards, including the Government of India's Padma Shri. Again, that's Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez, Saturday, May 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Baptist Church, located at 909 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to a bonus episode of Pacific Underground. This is a special episode that we're having for Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. It is a mouthful. I'm joined here today. I'm Jenny Okuyama, by the way. I'm joined here with
Kane Schlesinger,
Pamela Santos,
and Tabitha Teo.
So, in case you didn't know, the month of May is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which, if you remember it, if you were alive back in 1977, all of us in this room are just we're just so young, we just don't remember its origins. But it was originally introduced in 1977, and it was not actually passed originally. It was originally supposed to be 1 week, and it was signed by Jimmy Carter in 1978. So that's when the AAPI month started. But it actually started off as Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. It is now Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And we can get into the whole naming nuances. This month has gone through lots of different names. But so to just kind of sum it up, it was originally just a week, but in 1990, George W. Bush signed a bill that extended it from 1 week to becoming a month. And so since then, actually since 1992, we have had AAPI month every single May. And here's a little trivia for everyone to know. The reason that the month of May was chosen was because May was the month that the first Japanese immigrant came, and that was in 1847. And also, May was the month that the Transcontinental Railroad was finished, which had a lot of Chinese workers on it. So they thought it to be the appropriate month. And so we here on Pacific Underground, we're not finishing any major railroads or anything, but we are having a special episode today.
It seems like a decision that was like made for us by other people, right?
Yeah.
But I'll take it.
Yeah.
So before we launch into our first segment, hi, Pam. We're going to open with a piece from slam poet Bo Sia. This piece was released as a video on YouTube in 2007. It was a PSA. So let's go to that clip right now.
I don't need a gong to make my entrance. I'm Asian America. I'm already here. Want proof? Visit an army base, Google, or ride a train. Cause I'm Vietnamese rebuilding in the Gulf, Indians programming you from Houston, Koreans claiming the Dodgers, Filipinos nursing your babies, and Chinese just everywhere. My father is Bruce Lee. My aunt's husband is black. My children make the top plays on SportsCenter. I'm in your Bible study. You've seen me praying east. You're in my theology class at NYU, wondering if my cousin sent these from Japan. Don't you know me already, Daniel-san? Didn't you hear the Wu-Tang Clan shout me out? I pimp my own ride. I make fusion out of you. I voted for those who don't look like me, so let me be clear. It may be Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, but if you open your eyes, you'll find our heritage in every day of the year.
So that was some real talk from slam poet Bo Sia. I am not the most familiar with his work, but from what I've seen, his message in general, he also is on the HBO Deaf Comedy, or Deaf Poetry, Poetry Slam, thank you. His message is pretty much like, hi, we're here, we're everywhere. Not just when it's convenient to see us portrayed in media, playing out tropes and stereotypes that make non-API America feel comfortable watching at a distance. So I really dig that. I appreciate his message. We're going to get more into these types of issues later. But first, I want to turn toward you guys that are gathered here, Pacific Underground crew, and our experience. So about like 4/5 of us are here in the studio, and we're going to be having a roundtable later this hour. But first, I'm going to be interviewing our own Pamela Santos, so stay tuned. So when we were producing the show, we realized that we had different experiences and awarenesses of the Heritage Month. We weren't all on the same page. We were all on different pages. We had no idea of this when we were laying the groundwork for this segment, and actually for a surprisingly long time when we were trying to figure out what to do for this segment. So some of us had been celebrating our Heritage Month ritually through high school and college, grew up in cultures with large API representation. And some of us are old enough to remember, in theory, when API Heritage Month was enshrined by good old George H.W. Bush. But other people like me didn't even really know that it existed until, let's just say like figuratively last week. But it might be literally
maybe like a week and a half. Maybe.
But it's been a great week of awareness.
It's been really
enlightening. I found out about it a week and a half ago.
You guys are having the greatest week and a half.
So today
we have the rest of the month, you guys.
We're in the studio. We have all of us here. Pamela Santos is here. Pam's experience celebrating API Heritage Month extends beyond Oregon, way on the other side of the country. Takes place largely in New York, where there's a huge diversity in API ethnicities. Pam's Filipino American and has a rich and unique, albeit unconventional, experience celebrating API Heritage Month at different turns in her upbringing. So, hi, Pam.
Hey.
You're the one that came up with the idea that we do a bonus show this month about API Heritage Month. So, what's up with that? Let's get everyone up to speed on what the original thinking was behind this.
So for me, it was actually really normalized. I didn't really think of it as unconventional. And I also didn't think about it as, you know, this every single May, you know, my life stops and it changes and we have to just do this for 31 days. And it's not like that, but it's more of, I just kept thinking that when I brought it up to you guys, and just like, yeah, you know, we could do this. Like, we can, we'll do it like a last week with John Oliver segment. It'll be like an hour of us just saying, like, why do we need API Heritage Month? And then we close it with like a bang. And we're going to be like, because racism. And we're just going to keep doing this. So I really didn't think that I was alone in that idea. Quickly changed that thought process quickly changed. So
I want to go back a little bit and kind of start not quite at the beginning, but take a little walk down memory lane. You're from Queens, New York. For those of you
That New York like right after that.
Well, maybe some people don't know. Maybe some people are ignorant like me.
I know there's two Brooklyns, and it's just, I feel like there's a fake Brooklyn.
Oh my gosh, I live in the other Brooklyn, Pam. Are you about to call my Brooklyn fake Brooklyn?
Your Brooklyn is fake Brooklyn. Your Brooklyn is like the size of a Brooklyn, like,
it's
hair
the size
salon.
Of like a brook. It makes more sense. Just saying, shout out, Brooklyn love. And I'm talking about Brooklyn, Portland.
Oh, I feel, oh my God, that actually hurt. Like, that really, like, it like went right through my ear canal. And like I feel like there might be blood coming right out. That felt so,
you know,
terrible.
How cool my Brooklyn is? Clark Gable used to live in our neighborhood back like in 1920. So, you know, when people
Seriously?
Are like, Brooklyn represent Clark Gable.
You know what Clark Gable also did? He probably also remember the first like airplane flights. Like, I don't really, I mean, that's
well,
a well.
If we're going to be like John Oliver, if we're going to be like John Oliver, we should start our own hashtag the other Brooklyn.
Oh my God. Because that's...
See, we thought the show was going to be about AAPI month, but it's about hashtag the better Brooklyn.
Oh!
Okay. And Brooklyn beef. Brooklyn beef aside.
It's so strange to have that. So apparently,
I have no dog in this fight.
I'm holding it down for all of New York and not just for Queens. Apparently, so I was watching Captain America. I told you this. So I watched the latest one in the Civil War, and you know, they're having that little moment, him and Peter Parker, just going like, Queens, Brooklyn. You have a little moment. And that's how deep it goes. And so, but I don't think anybody really understands what it's like for me when I always, I'm always repping Queens or New York, because I didn't realize until I got here that it really impacted me to grow up with so many different ethnicities that, what is the picture of Queens? I grew up in different parts of Queens. So there was the part in when I first came from the Philippines when I was 3, and we lived where there's elevated subways, and that's the more, the less suburban parts. I want to say even just that one section of Astoria, Queens, there's another Astoria. That part... You would have, like, I would say 12 different ethnicities. You could have that on just one little part of it. So there's just so many different languages going on in just that one borough of New York. So imagine the rest of New York City. For me, going to grade school and having these international breakfasts, or you celebrate something with your class. And I had a really small class, I went to Catholic school. There's only 60 of us. So the white people over there, the white kids I grew up with, were super aware of what kind of white they were. So, and you knew that by what food they brought. So the Irish kids would know how much, like, depending on whatever soda bread or what, you know, their parents would make. Who has a little bit of German. The Portuguese girl, shout out, Elizabeth. I remember you. You always... we always knew. We were just like, no, you are not from Spain. You are from Portugal. She made it clear, because But it came from, and I was telling you guys this, it came from everyone having that awareness from maybe their families, maybe their parents or however it is, but it never took away from each other. So you could be really proud, like I could be really proud of being Filipino, but we weren't better, or it didn't come at the expense of somebody else. So you didn't have to tear somebody down. And I was thinking about this because later on we'll hear an interview from a youth leader here in Portland, just hearing kind of slurs and the kind of like overt racism that I experience here, and the microaggressions are actually even worse than the overt. There wasn't even either. Like there were very few that I could think of in New York, because it was just so normal that you knew what a black person looked like when they come, you know, like you're in a restaurant. And I feel like you understand that there's such a thing as being Afro-Latino. Like there's so many things. I think like white kids were in the minority. Maybe I'm just remembering it wrong. But I feel like we outnumbered the white kids.
So
that seems like a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot to take in. But when you were in high school, you were talking about you're talking earlier about how there are a lot of like clubs where you could sort of just interact with a lot of people that were of the same ethnicity as you, but also kind of like not. There was the Filipino club, right, and also Asia club.
Or Asian, oh wow, club. The Asian club was actually smaller than the Filipino club. So the Filipino club could be like 20 strong for what, the freshman year or something. And so there would be just like either 80 to 100 in a room. It could be maybe, no, I feel like it was still accurate. Maybe at its smallest. And I think I had a class, I graduated with a class of 700 kids. So the Filipino club would have all 4 years, and the Asian club was smaller, and the Asian club had the Indian kids and Pakistani kids, but there were more Indian kids. For lack of a better word for this, the other Asians that weren't Filipino or Indian in the Asian club. And aside from the food, like we could have an international night that was, every country was represented either by food or by dancing. So before it was just like food. Then it's high school, it's just like, oh, but you got to dance. So we'd have weeks to prepare to do different dances representing our different countries or cultures. And it wasn't limited. Like the Italian club was strong. Like I was in Queens, the part that had a lot of kids from like the Italian neighborhoods. So it was kind of all spread out, and I don't really, when I was talking to you all about this, what did you tell me? Like, it would have been hard to do an international night because...
I grew up in Salem, Oregon, just an hour south of Portland, and it is very white. I looked at the demographics and just recently, and within the last... last year, I think it was like 80% Caucasian. And I am pretty sure when I was growing up, it must have been a lot higher. So I grew up and there weren't any international celebrations because there just weren't enough, quote unquote, ethnic people to have like ethnic celebrations or international or culture nights.
I was just thinking, real quick, for those who are just tuning in right now and like, what are those people talking about on the radio? You're listening to a very special episode of Pacific Underground. Usually our show is on the fourth Friday of the month from 11 to 12. We will still be having our normal show, but for Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, we are having a very special episode here today where we're live in studio with members of the Pacific Underground team. And right now what we're doing is we're interviewing the wonderful Pam, and talking about her experiences with API Heritage Month or AAPI Heritage Month or APA Heritage Month.
So I just want to call it AZN, Asian Pride. I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
Are you going to start that?
No,
please. Can we petition the White House? No.
Hashtag.
Yeah, no. How many signatures it is that you need, like when you do a petition to the White House, and we can call it the AZN I think you might get some support on that.
I think
I would sign that petition.
That was way back, and I'm going to go deep, and I'm not going to explain this for people. That was back in Asian Avenue, Zanga times, maybe. Like, we would have had a better chance of that when cell phones did not have alphanumeric, like, keyboards. But anyways, I mean,
easy into life.
Yes, with a Y. But again, like, this is really bringing me back to misspelled life. So you brought that up, Tabitha, and I was telling somebody else why it was so different for me coming to Portland or to Oregon is that white people think the way that the experience I've noticed is where I grew up, white people weren't having this constant awareness of themselves being the default. No lie, white supremacy is still going to be everywhere, but at least for the identity and the awareness, they were aware of themselves having some kind of like other heritage. Like, they could be aware of that, or they could be aware that they're, you know, a transplant, not from New York. Like, there's some kind of identity going there. But it feels like here it's that white people think of themselves as the default without thinking about it that way, by acting in ways, and these are called microaggressions, by acting in ways that make people of color aware of themselves as different. So if they're the default, they treat Asians and Pacific Islanders and people of color, but especially Black people, and that's from like the farthest proximity to whiteness. So you have Black people and Indigenous people out there. They're made to feel their differences when, even in the nicest way of like, oh my gosh, what kind of food are you gonna bring? Like, I'm so excited if you know, like, if you're going to the PTA and like, what kind of food do you like? Wondering just what they think is your, oh, you're gonna love this part, like just loving to talk about your hair for some reason and fixate on that. I did that for you, Jenna. Okay.
Oh my God. Let me just say to everybody out there, don't touch people's hair. Just stop
ever.
It. Ever. Ever,
ever, ever.
And then exoticize it.
Ever.
We can go into so many stories. Well, I have a question for you though about growing up and talking about the white default. So you're saying that people in New York when you were growing up at least had more of an awareness of calling themselves like Italian or, you know, where they were from. Did they call themselves white? Or was it like,
okay,
I'm
so
Italian?
I'm thinking about this. So I'm Italian. I'm Italian American. I'm this. You had people being aware of, I always think about it as like white people that I grew up with understood what it was like to not be the majority. So, and I still am friends with people. I mean, forget it. Like, our Mets are having an amazing, like, this is a really good team for last year. I'm sorry, I had to bring it in. Everybody sees my Mets cap. And we keep in touch every single time I'm on air, Jenna. Every single time. Okay? Let's go, Mets. Anyway, all of us spread out through the country, Santa Fe, and some other folks, we keep in touch. And we talked about how when they went and moved to other cities, that it was so different for them to be with people who don't understand the differences between Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, or that you don't call people Spanish, that they speak Spanish, or what else could I think of? Just like all these other things, that Philippines is a country. Hi. I have to explain that several places, just want to say. So I have to explain a lot of things. And so it always feels like this uphill battle for me, and not for nothing, even surprisingly, to have like other API people tell me that they weren't aware that May was, it's our month, man. It's our month, yo. And we just want to say, it's almost like this opportunity, like we can share in this 31-day love of ourselves, and not realizing that when I left that I just had such a love of like this different parts of my identity. But not only that, that I really appreciated other people's identity. I almost feel like you couldn't have one without the other. Like, I could say all these things about it because we would have Philippine Independence Day parade, and it would be the week after the Puerto Rican Day parade, which was always bigger, but it was like nuts and amazing. And everybody was Puerto Rican on that day. It was bigger. It was actually better than St. Patty's Day because it's like the music's great.
Because on St. Patty's Day, everyone's Irish.
You know, but I'd rather be Puerto Rican. I don't know.
I want to go to New York now and just be Puerto Rican for a day. I want to be
Filipino. We walk down Madison Avenue and we're just eating the smelliest food. We're eating smelly food just in the street, and nobody's bothering you and telling you, Pamela, don't put that in the microwave. Like, no, I'm going to eat my fish balls, Becky. Sorry, Becky. We have a son named Becky.
We didn't know anyone named Becky.
Different Becky. Different Becky. I love this idea.
Shout out to Becky.
I love this idea that, like, the way we can protest being exoticized is, like, I'm going to walk down the street with my stinky fish balls and be like, what's up? Like, this is what I'm doing. Everybody come join me and love it. Yeah, because I would love to just put, like, mackerel on a stick and just, like, walk down the street, have it all over my face and be like, that's right, what's up?
Like no, I'm going to have Philippine blood soup. Dinuguan, thank you. That's going to be in the microwave, all right? Thanks, everyone. That I work with. Thank you.
I really want shrimp chips now.
So, oh my gosh, we just need to make Kabu smell like Asian heaven.
I know. And then, but to not to say that like everything, and we are already, you know why? Because I'll always talk about food. We're going to have a food episode. We are going to have a food episode for our next regularly scheduled episode. But I just felt like it was extra large right now, right? We had to talk about this API, ASEAN Pride.
Yes, yeah. For the rest of the show, should we call it the ASEAN Heritage Month?
No, because I feel like you just want to make this like very Star Trek and that we're having like our own.
I never thought of applying ASEAN to AAPI month, and it just makes me happy.
I had beepers. Don't you remember how everything doesn't make sense when you have beepers and you have to make words out of numbers?
My God, I forgot that's why we did that.
So it's our month, right? Did it feel like, I mean, this was kind of before I think you started celebrating it, but was there a lot of like, and this is kind of getting into something we'll discuss later in the show, but was there a shared Asian identity in Queens?
Okay. So growing up, it wasn't necessarily important. I have to actually struggle to think. I'm like, I can't actually really think of who the other like Asians were in my grade school other than the Filipinos. But I think there wasn't, I just don't think that there was a negative connotation. Like, it was really hard for me to actually remember, what am I saying? Asian. Hello. This is a reason why. So I actually grew up with Indian best friends and then I just went, whoops. But yeah, I think it was having everything so normalized that we could be really aware that we were different. Like, you're Indian, I'm Filipino, but we're going to eat each other's food. We're going to say hi to each other's moms. Be, you know, really respectful in each other's houses. That's a thing. Learn to dance in each other's basements. And at some point, I think it coalesced into activism, maybe. Like, I just want to say that it probably wouldn't have started without me having mentors and different people that kind of shook things up. As much as I was kind of plugged into that identity, it was even now that I think by comparison, when I keep talking to people, I informally polled like a bunch of people. Like, do you not know what May is? Like, I did this. And I think I want to say that it's because when I was 17, I got involved in a community organization where they took us on these Filipino-American history conferences. So, like, all of these other things wouldn't have happened probably unless I had, like, these college mentors and these, like, older kind of adults in the community that were telling me, like, yo, it doesn't start and end in the Philippines. Like, there have been Filipinos here since 1587. There have been Filipinos with different movements. They have been fighting in World War II and not getting benefits. There have been all of these different parts in American history. And I knew that at 17. So that I think that was pretty early comparatively.
So I want to kind of like fast forward into the college days and activism and kind of compare the two scenes. Like how did the social ethnic transition go between high school and college? Did you hang out with the same demographic?
I think it was just that it was already multi-ethnic. So it just happened that we were hanging out with other Asians, but also, I mean, Latinos, everybody, I think we're all together. It was more on your interests, I think. But it also, see, I didn't call them affinity clubs. I had other people tell me. I was like, why would you call that? You're the one that told me that, too. I was like, these are my identity clubs. Like, I don't know. And at that same time, too, I got to do more things like go to Broadway and off-Broadway shows. So I got to see Asian Americans acting and being in not only productions that were written by Asian American playwrights, but they could be in Mother Courage. Like, they could be in these really significant kind of American theater productions, but all Asian American. So I had all these different kind of experiences that it was just normalized. You go to film festivals, you see Asians on the screen. I guess, I don't know. I shouldn't even, if I talk about being like a Bruce Lee fan, like.
Oh man, we shouldn't even get you started.
No.
We only have like.
I know.
Last question. What kind of API world do you want to live in? I know it's pretty broad.
I know. And I want to keep it brief where I want people to not ask other APIs, where are you from? Where are you really from? That might be one start, I think.
That would be leaps and bounds if
right?
that could just happen.
Like, just don't say that because I know what you mean and you need to stop. And you need not to be surprised that I can speak English to your face. So, that got
Fair
extra
enough.
Queens right there.
Yeah, that
extra.
Could actually just be like a card that you hand to people when someone's like, where are you really from? And then you just hand them this card and then you just walk away. And at the top of the card just says stop. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
You guys were like, stop should be an acronym.
Okay, that'll be our homework. So that's about all the time that we have for this segment. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're all going to be sitting in the same place, and we're going to just change the topic, and we're going to talk about pan-Asian American identities and whether they're problematic or not. Hey, you're listening to Pacific Underground. If you're just joining us, it's Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, or any sort of variation on that. We're gathered here in the studio, and at the moment, we're going to have a discussion about APA or API Heritage Month and our experience with Pan-Asian American identities. So I'm joined here by, I guess you guys can introduce yourselves. I'm Kanan.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Tabitha.
Pamela.
That's who we are, y'all.
So we talked a little bit about Pan-Asian American identities, and it seemed like an important thing to bring up in this conversation, in this episode, because Asian Pacific Islander Heritage Month sort of forces us into this box. You know, like earlier in the month, we celebrated Black History Month, and, you know, not every Black person is from the same country. Everyone has their own heritage, but it does kind of coat everything in this uniform color. And it kind of forces us to assume these identities and maybe even make these connections that we wouldn't otherwise make. So I kind of want to just go around and share our experiences with that. In growing up, personally, I didn't grow up with a very robust API community. So I was not someone who really steeped in that and felt a very strong connection to people in my community. So I didn't even really identify as Asian American. So when I heard things like API Heritage Month, I sort of, it didn't resonate with me. It was just sort of like, yeah, that's something that I should probably learn about myself. But since I am mixed, I identified way more as just American and even white. So that's probably why when we began talking about doing this episode on API Heritage Month, I kind of was like, meh, I don't know why we would do that, while some of you guys were like more passionate about it. So that kind of sums up my experience with it.
Passionate meaning me.
Well, I think what's interesting is was kind of the opposite reactions that we had to it. I was really surprised. This is Jenna, by the way, that Pamela was like really gung-ho. It was, you know, she talked about it at the beginning of the show, you know, that she was really excited about it, that it was like this, oh my God, this is our month thing. And that is always actually the opposite. And so I think I surprised Pam when I was like, dude, I'm not so necessarily into AAPI or APA month, whatever you want to call it. We were talking about like our awareness of it. And I feel like when I'm trying to remember back, like when I first remember hearing about it, I know that I knew about it by college. So by the early 2000s, I knew that it existed. I'm sure, you know, I went to a high school that was 40% Asian and had a huge Asian club. And so I'm sure they probably did something for it. But I did not identify with the label of Asian. And I thought it was weird that we had an Asian club because I didn't think of myself as Asian. I still think of myself very much as Japanese American. So I identify definitely with being an American, but also being Japanese. But growing up, I wasn't very connected to the like Korean community and the Chinese community, which were the prominent Asian communities with where I grew up. And there was a lot of racism. Extra in case y'all didn't know out there, but not all Asians get along. There's a lot of racism. There's a lot of really emotional history between the different countries, especially with Japan during World War II. Everybody really has a lot of still fresh wounds about that. So I felt really disconnected from other Asians and calling ourselves Asians. We really didn't call ourselves Asians. People were Korean or they were Chinese or they were Filipino or whatever they were. And to me, Asian was just like this club that all the Asian kids joined because they all needed like stuff for their resume to get into college. And I found it problematic when people would try to fit me into this Pan-Asian identity because I felt, one, we were all really culturally different, and also that the immigrant experience is so drastically different, say, for like a Japanese-American person who's family, most likely, if you're Japanese here in this country, your family came over in like 1900. And so if you're my age, you're in generation four, while the Vietnamese people I would meet and often people from the Pacific Islands were recent immigrants who were being really, really marginalized and had a much different experience than me. And so I've always had a problem with being called Asian. And then especially when they're like, hey, Asian Pacific Islander, it's like, hey, let's get an even larger region so that we can include so many more people. I mean, I completely understand the reason why it is beneficial to come together as a community, because we are a quote unquote like minority in this country or whatever. So I get it, but personally, I find it problematic because it takes, I think it often takes away the stories from those who are marginalized the most.
I definitely feel my experience is really different because I grew up in Salem, and I grew up with the default, and I was certainly in the mentality that white is default because I was just surrounded by so many white people and surrounded by white culture. I did go to a Chinese American church, so every Sunday I interacted with Chinese people, and this was a connection to my heritage. But growing up though, like, never heard that May was, it's AAPI month, Heritage Month. No one in my church ever said anything. I never saw any signs around it at school. And I actually just found out this May that it was AAPI Heritage Month. And it's like, since I'm so new to the awareness of it, I guess I haven't had like a chance to like formulate an opinion about it. What we were saying about microaggressions, I mean, quite frequently I am reminded that you look different, because
you look so exotic, Tabitha.
I am really exotic.
Like, I don't even know what planet you're from. Oh my gosh.
So this is amazing because we have been just going right through through this show. We have an exciting interview to show you all, but before we do, just want to play a piece of a spoken word slam poem by Troy Osaki. He's based in Seattle, Washington. Fair warning, the piece is highly emotional and it gets a little intense.
When taking attendance in driving school, my classroom officer revealed what actor she thought each student resembled. When announcing my name, she looked at me and then replied, "Jackie Chan." As one of only two boys of color in class, I collapsed into my chair like the back seat of a patrol car, listening to the sound of white kids laughing like riot police letting their dogs loose. In 1982, Vincent Chin, a Chinese American, was beaten to death with a baseball bat by two white men, mistaking him as Japanese. Convicted killers Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz were sentenced to 3 years probation without serving a day in jail. Michael Nitz denied all accusations of killing on the basis of race, even after witnesses recalled him yelling, "It's because of you, we're out of work." Ebens and Nitz were then caught steering the barrel of a baseball bat into the pavement of Vincent Chin's skull, the crushing impact like an 18-wheeler against oncoming traffic, pieces of his brain scattered along the streets of Detroit like traffic cones. "Officer, when you called me Jackie Chan, I could hear Vincent Chin's corpse turn over like a car accident. Your carelessness is the reason why Asians feel the only way to fit in is to appear less foreign. We are taught to concentration camp our culture, exclusion act our ancestry. We are constantly questioned, where are you from? As if we do not belong, never American born, always made in China. Our heritage is not a punchline you can tell to make yourself feel electric. Your laziness to understand our differences is enough shock to complete circuit a set of jumper cables. If anyone's eyes are slanted, it is America's narrow view of how all Asians look the same." In 1982, the first mobilization of a pan-Asian movement was sparked by the murder of Vincent Chin. Asians across ethnic lines gathered in solidarity to push for justice like a Southern car pileup. Protests and rallies against racism did not bring back the life of Vincent Chin, but it gave birth to the political voice of Asian Americans. Vincent Chin, was slain two nights before the day of his wedding. His mother and fiance, forced to mourn the loss of their loved one, refused to let his legacy be forgotten. Generations later, we are still working to abolish anti-Asian violence. From classroom jokes to public executions, we refuse to ever be forgotten.
That was slam poet Troy Osaki reading his work in Oakland in 2014. We felt that it would be a really important clip to air because it gets directly at the type of oppression that API Heritage Month seeks to educate against and ultimately overcome. A large part of this battle is fought in the classroom. To get some perspective on the recent ethnic studies requirement that will be making its way into some Oregon public schools by 2018, producer, all of us really worked to try to get this interview with two high school students working with the group API Leaders for Liberation of Youth, or ALLY.
So my name is Jessica Yu. I'm an API Leaders for Liberation of Youth, which stands for ALLY Leader. I'm a junior currently at Franklin High School. I joined ALLY when I was a sophomore, so the beginning of like 2014. Maybe it was fall. It was the fall.
My name is Kenny Wu, and I am a freshman at Franklin High School, and I am also a member of ALLY Youth. And I joined in eighth grade, a bit after ALLY was created. I think we started early summer last year, which was not long after we started our group. And first we kind of got together and asked ourselves, what do we need to change in our community or in our schools? And so in the end, we decided with ethnic studies to be implemented into high schools all around Portland. And so after a year, we've come to an end. We won our campaign, and by 2018, we will have ethnic studies throughout our high schools.
That's amazing. I watched all the news of my feed, everything pretty much going on when you were putting together the presentation for the PPS school board. And so it was really good news to hear that it passed, and I saw the video.
Yeah, sort of to add on to that, so the organization started around fall 2014. So last year in the summer of 2015, we had a Allies retreat. So we knew that we wanted a campaign, but we weren't sure what we wanted. So we got it down to about three topics. I think it was health, education, and then there was something else. We all voted together. It was something that was decided by the youth, run by the youth, and won by the youth eventually. So we decided on education, and there were actually two members that brought up that maybe we should do ethnic studies because they saw a documentary about the program in Tucson, Arizona, the ethnic studies program that was there, and we thought that that's something we're pretty down for.
I'm really curious, what's the documentary?
Precious Knowledge, right?
Yeah,
Precious Knowledge.
And when you're thinking about ethnic studies, did people share their experiences about why they needed it? I mean, why don't you tell us, why did you think you needed ethnic studies in your high schools?
Well, I think we definitely got some voices around from other people, and they say that it would be a good thing our grades would go up, and definitely more people would graduate.
So I had world history. I had a pretty good teacher. So we weren't just learning about like European American history, but I noticed a lot of it was specifically API, they were always the victims. We were always viewed in the lens of a victim. In US history, again, I have a pretty good teacher. They teach us about other things aside from just like typical, just white American history. But the thing is, when you don't see people that look like you in your textbooks, when you don't see people of color represented in your textbooks, then you don't really know that you can succeed. You don't really understand that, yeah, this is something I can do. Going into college is something I can do, having protests and standing up for equality, just not just Asian American equality, but just all across the pages, pages like attacking patriarchy, capitalism is possible, and people of color have done this before. It's just that we're not learning about it.
So you're in high school now. So just even any of the history books or however you have experienced American history before, did you see yourselves, did you see Asians reflected in American history?
I personally did not see it in any of the textbooks about the U.S. histories, although in seventh grade I did learn about other cultures and other countries, but that was one whole book dedicated to many of those cultures rather than in eighth grade, where I had one whole book dedicated to U.S. histories.
Okay, so I didn't really realize that Asian Americans or Asians in general weren't reflected in our textbooks until someone asked the question, when did you see someone who looked like you in your textbooks? And I was like, I've never had. I just never seen anyone who was Asian American in my textbooks. The only thing I've heard about was maybe the Vietnam War, the Korean War, or how the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, but we never hear about anything else aside from that. And I think that was the pivotal moment where I was like, why don't we see this? This is the time, we need this now. Especially in Portland, where there's such a large population of people of color, specifically like Chinese Americans. But there's also a very large population of just white people. It's like, we need to have these conversations. We need to start talking about other cultures. We need to start talking about the people of color experience, because it's important to have this now, especially when we're about to have presidential elections. And there are certain candidates that attack people of color, for sure.
So from your perspective, is it like in your prospective schools, do you feel like there is a large POC population, like in the circles that you're in?
In the circles I am in, for sure, there's a lot of people of color. But the thing I've realized is that a lot of the people of color don't explicitly talk about their culture. They try to mask it. In middle school, I've seen this a lot. There were a lot of Asian Americans in particular, but they don't talk about how they're Chinese. They don't say, like, this is who I am, this is how it affects me, and that they are Chinese. Like, you will hear words like, you're a chink, you're a slant, and it's just given off as a joke. And I think sort of that vibe, accompanied along with not having ethnic studies, sort of cultured ourselves into believing that we don't really need to hear about ourselves.
I had like a severe delayed reaction to hearing chink and slant. Like a severe delayed reaction. I wanted to be like, oh, hey, hey. Is that like a joke? That are you saying, like, you know, just to be able to have that as like joking around or something?
Well, I was actually reflecting back on this sometime this year. In sixth grade, there are people who would just say, oh, you're so chinky, and then they'll, like, pull their eyes back.
Oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they'll pull their eyes back, and it's given off as a joke. And at that time, I didn't feel like it was offensive. I didn't feel like they were making fun of me. It was like, oh, I'm rolling along with it. They're thinking I'm their friends. I'm their friends.
What was their background?
They were usually white. So it was like, I don't think they intended to give it off that type of vibe. Especially knowing them now, they're more, like, they're more reflective upon what they say. And I think it's, I mean, it's not just Portland. I think it's just a culture that we are growing in where it was acceptable to say those things. And I think as not just the parents, but as students ourselves, we need to be able to tell when we're saying something that should not be said. And I think a lot of that is that we don't hear about that during our history classes. Like, you should know that it's wrong to say chink or slant or gook to someone who is Asian American. I think, honestly, as when you're young, when you're like in sixth grade or seventh grade or eighth grade, because, well, I don't know about everyone else, but as a person of color, you don't really, you always look to other people to see like how you're supposed to act. So when no one calls them out on it, you're like, maybe this is supposed to be okay. So I don't think it tipped them off, because you just never were taught that it was wrong.
And even for for me, it took some time because it wasn't available in, I want to say, like grade school or high school history books, kind of the recent history around, I would say, for the 1960s, that whole civil rights movement era. It was largely covering, you know, it's important to talk about the Civil Rights Act and the rise of Black power and Asian Americans. I found out later, activists definitely participated in the liberation of African American brothers and sisters, which added to their movement. And that's something that I didn't come to until college. So you have to wait until college before you realize your own potential for liberation. That's at least my experience.
But. Yeah, so I've actually had sort of that exact same experience, except I didn't learn it in my U.S. history class. I was doing a research paper on someone named Janice Mercatani, and she was one of the first people who were working on the ethnic studies program at San Francisco. So that was when I started learning, like, this time period is not just a time period for Black power. It was a time when Asian Americans stood up to the occasion and stood side by side by people of color and started like this movement that I can see today in Apano. It's just, I was wondering, like, why did I not hear about this? Why did I not know about this? And at the same time, it's like, I know a lot of people are saying, like, so here's the thing. We learn a lot about the African-American movement, and that is super important. I'm not saying that's not important, but at the same time, there's a lot of other people of color that don't always have their histories told. And I'm saying both are very important, and I just wish that sometimes we can also hear about the Chicano American experience, the Latina American experience, and also the Asian American experience.
And especially those experiences where we were in solidarity with each other.
Exactly.
So with the American farm labor movement, you had Chicanos and Filipinos working together in that same movement, but not as much visibility for the Filipino farm leaders, labor leaders. Kenny and Jessica, is it okay if I ask, and you can feel free to like respond or not respond or something, but do your parents talk about what it's like to be your individual, like, identities, like being Asian?
I do not think so. I have never heard about them talk about me being myself as my individual identity.
So my parents are first generation immigrants, Chinese American immigrants. I think coming into here when they're trying to find a job, trying to make sure the family's stable at that time, they don't really realize that there is such an identity as Asian American, that there is a separate experience of Asian Americans from, like, anyone else. So I think they just didn't notice.
So that's a shortened version of an interview that we had. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, so we will be posting a longer form version of that interview so you can hear the entirety of that. So check us out online. But that was Pamela Santos sitting down with Jessica Yu and Kenny Wu, both of whom are high school students working with API Leadership for Liberation of Youth, or ALLY. We'll be posting a longer form version of the interview later on the web this week, so be sure to check it out. And you can see that on SoundCloud or on our Facebook page. So we're at the end of our show, but this has been a very special live episode of Pacific Underground, and we wished you all the happiest of API or AAPI, whatever you want to call it, Heritage Month. And thank you to the whole Pacific Underground team and our board op, Lisa Loving, thank you, and KBOO. As always, a very special thanks to our producers for today, which are Pamela Santos and Kanan Schlesinger, and to Chops for our theme music. For more, you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground, or you can always download our shows on SoundCloud and iTunes. And make sure to check out our next show, which is on Friday, May 27th from 11 to 12 p.m. here on KBOO Portland. And it will be airing I'm sorry, I'm getting lost in my script here. We've been talking here about to the API community members about food on our next show. So we will cast a wide net about collected food stories and how it shaped people's lives, brought people together, and kept people apart. It'll be fascinating and possibly hunger-inducing. It was a real education for all of us to collect the stories, and we can't wait to share it with you. So until then, thanks everybody for listening, and thanks for supporting KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, As Time Goes By in Shanghai, showing Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. As Time Goes By in Shanghai tells the story of Shanghai's Peace Old Jazz Band, performing together since 1980. Aged between 65 and 87 years, many of them have been playing jazz since the 1940s and have seen the world transform. From the Japanese occupation and the Cultural Revolution to capitalism on overdrive, the band members have seen the many faces of China and withstood government suspicion of jazz. Again, that's As Time Goes By in Shanghai, Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the One Love World Music Party Cruise, Friday, May 27th on the Portland Spirit. Boarding takes place at 10:30 p.m. The One Love World Music Party Cruise features Portland reggae band Roots Revolution and DJ Solo Afrikaans.